to the political cesspool known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
And standing in tonight for the ever-popular James Edwards is off tonight, and standing in for him is Bill Rowland, the off-brand co-host, but nevertheless doing the best I can to fill the charismatic presence of James Edwards. So I'm wearing a special fancy hat for that purpose. You can't see it, but it does, I think, give me a little boost in self-esteem while I do this show. Welcome to the Political Cesspool, all of you who are joining us in the second hour. And once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners at KOHI in Portland, Oregon. We're so glad to have you on board and listening with us tonight. Now, my guest for this hour is filmmaker Craig Boddicker, who produced, directed, and appears in the fantastic, excellent documentary on race, A Conversation About Race. And for those of you out there who have not seen Craig's film, it is absolutely one of the most jaw-dropping experiences that I've had watching a documentary, because it clearly exposes the hypocrisy and the double-mindedness and really, I think, the blind adherence of liberals to the false doctrine and the false beliefs about racism. And we have with us now Craig Boddicker. Craig, as always, welcome to the Political Cesspool.
Well, thanks so much, Bill. Thanks for having me, and please give my best to James as well.
Oh, I will. Well, James always gets the best from everybody. I get the crumbs off the table, but that's okay.
You're the off-brand host.
I'm the off-brand host. That's right. But I got first-rate guests.
Oh, you're a good talker.
Craig, I guess I don't need to say too much that about your documentary, A Conversation About Race, being a success. But give us some idea of how much of a success it is. Give us some updates on the current status of A Conversation About Race.
Well, as a matter of fact, I've got a theatrical distributor telling me that he wants to put it in theaters this year. But, you know, those kind of things, they're never really real until they happen. You know, it's not a Hollywood deal by any means, but in Hollywood deals, you know, for every movie we see, there's like seven that never got made.
Right, exactly.
You know, so,
how many
the success has been really good. I'm really lucky that a lot of, maybe some black conservatives picked up and said some good things about it too, and that kind of led the way for the Wall Street Journal to come in and say, you know, the nice things that they said about it as well.
Well, certainly, anyone who watches the film is, you know, immediately begins to sense that the people who make their comments about race and racism are sort of lost at the end of their leash. They really don't quite see that their brains are sort of split down the middle on this when it comes to white racism versus other groups and perceptions of racism. So I think that's the real fascinating thing about watching this film is you watch these people sort of deconstructing their own beliefs before your very eyes.
Well, and that's the neat part about it is I've heard, you know, Bill, see people say bad things about the subjects of the film. They say, oh, they're stupid or boy, ha ha, we sure showed them. But the truth is, all of them were brave in their own right. In fact, in front of a camera, in front of a stranger, they actually searched their own souls and they actually questioned themselves for the first time in directions that most of them have never questioned themselves. And so I will give them credit. In fact, here's what I'll do. James is not there, but I'll give you a little exclusive here. The truth about A Conversation About Race is that it was shot to be feature length. It wasn't supposed to be an hour. So I've
got
another half an hour of footage that I'm putting together right now.
Oh, outstanding. So we'll get a director's cut, in a sense, of A Conversation About Race. That is the, I guess, outtakes and other scenes that you deleted in order to make it an hour-long film.
Exactly right. The stuff that we really liked that just couldn't make it as crisp as we really wanted to, so we're going kind of a different route. Instead of doing the black and white and the chroma key and all the technical stuff we did to make it look stripped down, we're actually going to show it stripped down. We shot it in color. We shot it with a green screen. And so we're going to show full color, show the characters, the subjects in full color, get to know them all a little bit better. One neat thing that I found out is that in their own way, each one of these subjects, regardless of the you know, maybe silly things that some of them said, each of them ended up saying something smart at one time or another too. So I tried to include that in the supplemental as well. That's what we're calling it, by the way, the supplemental, because there's actually about a good half hour's worth of value in addition to the 60 minutes we put into a conversation about race.
Well, I'm gonna just in my opinion, I'm gonna say that I think that the film being in black and white is sort of a statement about race itself, and actually I think makes the film interesting to watch. So I'm gonna have sort of a new experience with it being in color, because the black and white sort of gave it sort of a dramatic feel. And a feel of what they used to call the street level films, for instance, that were made by Truffaut and some of the Italian filmmakers.
Sure.
So it's almost going to be a new film entirely if it's in color and of course feature length.
Well, I think you make a really good point, Bill, because it would be hard for me to charge money for just the same thing, for going back into the same case. So what I'm trying to do is kind of get a little deeper into it. And also, I'd like to kind of spread the word that I didn't really do anything that was that incredible. A lot with the technology that's out there today, with Mac software and things like that, a lot of people can make their own films today. So one thing you can do by seeing this supplemental is you can kind of see some of the stuff that we did to make this movie, and you can also see some of the mistakes that I made, because they're going to be in there too.
Well, do you think that this, the new material that you're going to add into the lengthened version of A Conversation About Race, is there more humor?
I'm sorry, Bill. I didn't mean to give – it's not actually going to be a lengthened version. It's a separate supplement. Conversation About Race has to stand on its own. It's a one-hour piece, the black and white, the kind of grittiness of it. It's got to stand completely on its own. So this is basically a half-hour follow-up, only instead of going that same gritty direction, we're just going to keep it in color, keep it a little lighter, not quite as heavy as A Conversation About Race.
Okay, but I would assume from what you just said that there is sort of more humor, more commentary that perhaps is not quite as you say as dark or as serious.
Right, exactly right. There's more humor in this. There's also some of the same contradictions. There's some specific questions that we used that we just couldn't fit in, so we'll put those in there too. And it's really nice to kind of, because if you've seen the film a couple of times, we all kind of form our opinions about each of the subjects. But it's nice to see another fresh look at them. You see them in color, and you hear them saying a couple other things, and kind of reinforces the images that we have of these characters. And some of them you'll say, yeah, that's what I thought. And the other one you might say, oh, well, what do you know? Maybe she's not as stupid as I thought she was.
Let's get to the subjects for a minute, the subjects of the documentary. Now, can you give us a little follow-up on some of the people who are in the film? You don't have to mention by name, but sort of describe or give us some some information about some of these people that, of course, we don't learn in the film, but you have learned subsequently their reaction or maybe some response you got from them as far as their appearance in the film.
Well, people say this is strange, but the truth is I've never heard from any of them.
Wow.
I've never made any contact to initiate after I made the film, and nobody's ever contacted me. So at this point, I've never talked to any of the subjects themselves about their reactions to the film. Things that I've learned about some of the subjects, let's see, the Tina was kind of I wasn't supposed to say the names, and there I said the name. Let's talk about a different person besides that one I just mentioned. Here's a completely different person, and we find out this other person was at the time a white woman who's actually very serious into only dating black men. If you ever heard of any white women who did that?
Never.
okay. I find out that actually she lived with a Jamaican guy. And I didn't know this before we filmed the movie, so I guess that's not a real good tidbit. So what? She lived with a Jamaican guy. But as far as reactions to the film, no. The subjects themselves, I haven't heard any reactions.
So I guess this person you're talking about in the film actually had a personal stake in proving she wasn't a racist, which I think is rather interesting.
Well, in other words, it seems like there was maybe a conflict, maybe lack of objectivity, so to speak.
Right, but I don't recall anyone in the film ever saying, oh, by the way, I date a Jamaican guy, I'm living with a Jamaican guy, so that's changed my perspective. That never comes up, which I think is interesting. They try to keep it on this sort of abstract level in just talking about race within the context of semantics and not actually talking about it on a physical level like that. Like, hey, I've always dated black men. Craig, we've got a break coming up. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this commercial message.
Don't go away. There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages.
Welcome back. To get on the Political Cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
And once again, this is not James Edwards. This is Bill Rowland standing in tonight for James Edwards with my guest, filmmaker Craig Boddicker, and we are talking about his film, A Conversation About Race, and some new material that he will be producing and distributing very soon that is supplemental to that very fine documentary that he made just a couple of years ago. And so this is new material coming out. And Craig, let me ask you this about the original A Conversation About Race, the one-hour documentary. When you began making this documentary, what were your expectations? What did you anticipate you were going to get from the subjects in the film?
Boy, that's a good question, Bill. I wasn't sure. You know, I had this vision in my head that when I started looking at the issue, I think you know that I come from a neocon background, pro-Republican. I voted George Bush twice. I had, you know, Bush signs in my yard. So I've kind of made quite a conversion, but I've started looking at some of the, you know, serious conservative sites, and seeing what the real issues are to conservatives. And I thought this issue of race was really a big one that seems to be an elephant in the room that no one wants to really talk about too much. So I thought, well, what if I could actually document some of the reactions to people when they realize that their thoughts may be a little convoluted? What if I could document those reactions and then get them on film? I thought, well, okay, that should be a pretty good film. Too bad I didn't know a filmmaker. You know, so I thought, well, the next thing I'm going to have to do is probably learn to make a film, you know, a little better than the home movies that I've played with in the past. So as far as my expectations were concerned, it was pretty up in the air. I thought if I make it with quality and if I hire good people and keep the message civil and maybe entertaining a little bit, then yeah, maybe I will have some success with it. I didn't expect to get reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. I didn't expect Dr. Carol Swain from the National Institute of the Humanities, or I think that's what it's called, to review the film as well. She was grateful. Elizabeth Wright from a blog called Issues and Views. It's a black conservative blog. Thanks to some of the black conservatives, I've had more success. There's some people trying to wedge me into this white nationalist or white supremacist, whatever kind of a mold people are trying to fit me into. It doesn't work too well when I've got black conservatives coming out and joining me.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't think you would have expected that reaction. But, I certainly wouldn't have. But I do think it's important because it makes you wonder if perhaps secretly Eric Holder or some of the more strident black leaders and, black spokesmen, Eric Holder or Al Sharpton have secretly watched the film in a closet somewhere and are wringing their hands. Because
I hope so.
Well, I do too. But, I wonder at the, you know, to me, the film exposes so clearly the contradictions around this word and the false perceptions that anyone watching it who is a liberal who embraces these perceptions has to feel like a fool. I can't see it any other way. You look at yourself and you see these people in yourself and you begin to realize you believe the same things and they're sort of looking a little strange. You know, do you feel like that? Let me ask you this. Has anyone written you, for instance, an email or a letter or a response to your film saying, boy, I didn't know how silly I sounded or looked until I saw your film.
I've gotten a few that are somewhat close to that. You may be surprised. Usually what I'm sure you can guess the normal reaction when said liberal sees the film and they see themselves, the normal reaction is violent and it's anger and it's, how dare you? It's completely not, you're not a scientist. What do you know about anything? So I get a lot of that. But, God, I'm sure I had a brain fart. Where were we going with this?
Language, please.
Sorry. That's not a word you could use.
This happens always to me. Why me?
Sorry, Bill.
But that's okay. In any event, you know, I think that you know, that the reaction you're talking about is clearly one of someone who has been burned, though. I've noticed that as the editor of the Citizens Informer and having been the webmaster of the Council of Conservative Citizens website, that this reaction means that you've hit a nerve. You've really you struck a nerve with them, and their reaction is actually what I would have said. This is the typical liberal who has just got his pants set on fire.
Well, and you're right. Thank you for getting my train of thought back. I got an email from a guy in not Iceland. Where the heck was he? Up in Norway, and I've been selling a lot of copies up in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, places like that. And I got a guy who said that his best friend is half Japanese and half Norwegian, and he watched the film 3 times. And he said when he was done, he was so amazed that he used this word racist for all his life, and he never once ever thought about what it meant. And so the man who wrote me the letter said the fact that this guy's half Japanese, I guess he was intimating maybe a high IQ or something like that. But the fact is, this guy watched the film 3 times and said, you know, all my life I've done this behavior. I've used this word when the truth is I've never even questioned it. And so I think that when I hear a letter like that, I mean, yeah, you'd expect most of them to be hostile and how dare you? And yeah, that terrible, you know, that panic reaction when they realize the truth. What's it called? What they used to call it? Gay panic?
Gay panic.
That's a different thing. That's a different thing altogether anyway.
Well, that's when the homosexuals, I think, would be,
when they realize,
when they're caught in a bathroom or something and, you know, all of a sudden their life is coming apart, you know, in the police station, and somebody's going to call the wife and the family and inform them of what they've been, you know, why they've been arrested. And I think that's a good point. I think psychologically, the reaction is similar, is, oh, I've been exposed. I'm standing here with my pants down, and what am I going to do but scream obscenities? Well, you know, I think the reaction is clear. But you mentioned now you sold a lot of copies in Norway. What other countries besides the United States? I guess the list is pretty long, but significantly, you know, you wouldn't think that Norway would be a big market for a DVD like that.
Well, actually, yeah, the white, you know, for lack of a better term, the white countries in Europe have been a real good, you know, sales, knock on wood. And considering the fact that it's a Zone 1 DVD, I mean, I think technically it's not supposed to work in Europe. I mean, the way I had them burned, you got to try to save money where you can. And
sure.
So I originally burned the DVDs to work in America, not, you know, universally. I don't even know if they make a universal DVD. But in any case, people are buying it. So I guess they maybe have American DVD players over there.
Well, it would be interesting to find out how well the DVD would do and would sell with subtitles. For instance, German subtitles, Italian subtitles. You might have a market there because – of course, you might get arrested in Germany if you ever go there for making the film.
Well, I've scrutinized the film, and I'm not sure there's anything that anybody could call hate in there, but there's definitely some pro-white sentiments.
Well, that's enough to get you arrested in Germany for sure. And some other countries, probably in England too. But, you know, I tell you, I'm really interested in this supplement that you've made. And can you give us some tidbits? Some teasers about what's in there so we can, you know, get people interested in buying it, not only the original but also the supplemental?
Well, let's see what I can do. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to release this when I speak at the American Renaissance Conference coming up. I'm going to try to show at least a part of it during my little speech there. So that's the hope. I can release it then. But if I can give you one little tidbit, I think one question some people have asked me is, did any of the subjects make me angry during the interviews? And the truth was, one or two of them kind of did. And so I'll highlight a little bit. There was one guy who is not an American citizen. He's a Mexican citizen. whose attitude towards America just really rubbed me the wrong way, and maybe it was the wrong time in the day or something like that. So yeah, I didn't blow up at him, but yeah, he kind of got under my skin a little bit. So you maybe hear a little bit of me not as professional as I'd like to be.
Well, that's interesting because you really keep your cool in the original documentary, and in fact are almost too cordial, just way too cordial with some of these people. I think I'd have been pulling my hair out. We got another break coming up, Craig.
That was the hardest part. trying to remember that because I've got a whole war here, not just a battle.
Okay, we'll be right back after this.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool Guys will be back right after these messages. To get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool, call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
And welcome back to the Political Cesspool. I am co-host Bill Rowland, filling in tonight for James Edwards, and my guest this hour is filmmaker Craig Boddicker, and we're talking about his outstanding documentary, A Conversation About Race, and also about the new supplement to A Conversation About Race, outtakes and deleted scenes from the original that will be put into production and will be available and add much to the original documentary, but not the same as the original documentary, because this version is in color and promises to be entertaining as well as informative. Now, Craig, we were talking about some of the people who have watched your video and I guess have changed their views or have gotten angry about their own views. And I mentioned Eric Holder during the break, and you sort of popped up on that. What about Eric Holder?
I didn't mean to give you the impression that I know anything about the guy. It's just that, you know, I see guys like this. These are black guys that are elevated to positions of power, and I just can't believe the stuff, the remarks that come out of their mouths. What did he say? White people are cowards, or Americans are cowards because of our positions on race, or something like that. If we could just reverse the race on any of these silly statements these people make, and we say that, for example, black people are cowards or Hispanics are cowards, I mean, I'd be burned alive if I said something like that. But it's just you can say white people are this or that with impunity today. I mean, it's just amazing. One of the things I did feature in this new supplement is that I tried to get to the heart of the conventional wisdom on race, and what I really found out was that it's okay to be a little bit anti-white. It's encouraged. You don't have to acknowledge it at all. It's just part of the culture. You never have to say anything bad about white people. It's just kind of buried in the subtext. For example, the issue of slavery. If you ask most people today about slavery, they'll say, well, white people they're kind of guilty for that. You know, and black people are kind of innocent over here, and white people are kind of guilty. But that is such a naive take on what happened with the nightmare and the horror of slavery. It's a long issue, but in other words, Bill, 90% of the slaves that were taken from Africa were actually shipped to South America. And only about 3% ever made it to America. So whenever they talk about the slave industry, they always talk about the African trade to the Americas. Well, why don't they talk about the trade to the America? I mean, because the money's here, they don't want to go after where the 90% of the slaves were taken and abused. They go after where the 3% were, because that's where the money is.
Yeah, there's not much point in talking about the slave trade and the shame that took place in French Guiana. That's, pretty much a dead end.
Yeah.
Or Haiti, for that matter. But, of course, it's also true that the Arabs traded longest and heaviest in the slave trade, more than any European country, and continued it longer and probably captured and eventually killed more slaves than anybody else. It was the Arab slave trade.
Well, that is a real sensitive issue. But most of the research that I've done, agrees that if you want to break it down to race, it's absurd to say that white people are any more guilty for the history of slavery than any other race. I mean, you mentioned the Arabs, you mentioned, you know, swarthy Middle Easterners, you mentioned, you know, if you look at the Barbary Coast, you know, back in, what is it, the 18th century in the Barbary Coast, when it was pretty routine that blacks would kidnap whites for the slave trade.
Well, of course, there were white slaves for centuries in Europe to the Romans and the Greeks and,
sure.
and other people. Whites have been slaves too, but that apparently has gone down our memory hole. You know, we don't hold these ancient resentments and want reparations from, the Romans for the German or English slaves
right.
that were held. But nevertheless, it comes down to this idea that there is an innate white guilt pattern that whatever has gone wrong in the dark countries or the black countries or the African or Asian countries, that the automatic response is, well, it's the white man's fault. And we're seeing this in Haiti. The failure of whites to properly respond from the Haitian viewpoint to the earthquake. I don't know if you saw the news item about the 82nd Airborne Troops who were distributing nutritional wafers and water in Haiti, and the Haitians were grabbing them and throwing them on the ground and stomping them and throwing the water bottles back at the soldiers. This is their response, their gratitude for, you know, being given something to eat and drink. Well, they're tired of this now. They want something better. This plays into the idea that we're not doing enough. And you know, you get that, I think, in your film, is that it's always the white people who are made to feel like we're just not doing enough. And again, I guess I'm on a train of thought I'm going to stay on. Nicolas Sarkozy came out with a statement that France needs more affirmative action, needs to have more non-French elected officials, meaning Muslims and Africans, and that France must simply accept the idea of racially amalgamating with the Arabs, Muslims, and Africans. That this should be national policy in France, and in his words, in order to save France. Do you see this as part of our mentality? We have to destroy ourselves to save ourselves? I mean, that doesn't seem logical.
That is the dichotomy. That's the real question. In other words, if you take it, if you ask people to extend logically their feelings on race, most liberals agree when you press them and when you, like I did in the film, and when you really ask them questions based on their previous answer, what you'll find out is that most liberals have a desire for everyone to become mixed, one big giant mixed race. In fact, one theory that I have is most people who are mixed race seem to have a desire for all other humanity to join them and then be mixed race. Which I'm not saying it's good or bad or better or worse, but I seem to have noticed that anytime you have a group of people that are mixed race, they seem to be they'll vote for any policy that's there that's gonna bring the races, what they think, together. We'll all blend together. Now, you know, we know that it doesn't really work like that. That you people who are mixed race have trouble getting bone transplants and things like that. We're not going to turn into this super being. We're going to turn into, you know, for lack of a better term, a mongrel people. And people ask me about, you know, my relationship to white nationalists and things like that. Well, one point I'll make about the white nationalists is that they have a valid point. If all people interbreed and become one, well, white people will cease to exist. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And as soon as you tell a group of people that you have to cease to exist, you know, wars have been fought for that. And sooner or later, I think we're seeing it today, that a lot of white people are waking up and saying, well, just because, you know, wait a minute, I don't want my, let me put it another way, Bill. What if I want my grandparents to look like, or my grandchildren to look like me? Is that a bad thing? Is that a hateful thing? And in fact, if I find out that my grandchildren are not going to look like me, and I kind of don't like that, does that make me a bad person?
What's going on is really a eugenics program, a liberal eugenics program that is the negative reverse of the Hitlerian Nazi eugenics program, which is that we're going to amalgamate to destroy the white race, but we're going to create a super race from the destruction of the white race, which is a eugenics program itself, and it's a validation of race. It's actually saying that race matters so much that we have
to
destroy it.
Great point.
That, we have to destroy it because it really does matter. On one hand, we're told it's a social construct. It doesn't exist. On the other hand, we're told that we have to get rid of the concept of race by organic means, which is basically affirming that race really exists.
Right, but exactly right. And, well, I mean, they say that race doesn't exist. At the same time, you know, we have to constantly acknowledge that whites are the oppressors, and I really hate this term, but the people of color are the oppressed. Now, I'll mention the reason I can't stand that term. I think it's a really offensive term, and I think a lot of white people should get hip to this, that anytime anyone, especially in the media or our government, uses this term, people of color, what are they saying about us? What are they saying about people, you know, with European ancestry? We're nothing. We have no color. We're plain vanilla. We're nothing. So, in other words, other people, other races of people, or mixed race people are exotic, and they're interesting, and they're people of color. But the truth is they're pretty much brown and black. But then the white people, we're all different colors of the rainbow, physically speaking, but we're not people of color. We're just nothing. We're a blank slate, to put it that way. And luckily we have this diversity to come along and fix us.
Well, that's moving us towards invisibility. When you have no color, you become invisible.
Good, yeah.
You're a cipher. And of course you're right, and this is why people out there, whether you agree with us or not, they need to buy your film and they need to watch it to see the contradictions involved in discussions about race. And then, in fact, we do have value. We are people. I do want my grandchildren to look like me and my grandparents and my ancestors. And we're not going to give up that hope just because there are people who are out to destroy us. Craig, we'll be back for the last quarter hour after these messages.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool Guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the Political Cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
And welcome back to the Political Cesspool. I'm co-host Bill Rowland, standing in tonight for James Edwards, who had some social commitments he had to keep. And my guest tonight, once again, is filmmaker Craig Boddicker. We've had a great discussion with him about a conversation about race and the new supplement, the new completely new production that is outtakes and material not used in the original that Craig is going to produce and distribute. And you can find out more about A Conversation About Race and actually purchase a copy of this excellent DVD at Craig's website, aconversationaboutrace.com. Go there, take a look at what the reviewers say, take a look at little bits of the film, and I'll guarantee you, you'll have to have a copy. And I recommend it very highly if you don't already have a copy. We do have time for maybe one caller if anybody wants to call in and talk to Craig. And again, that number is 1-866-986-6397. Give us a call if you got a question for Craig or want to make a comment if you've seen his film, and we'll take those calls now. Craig, getting back to things for just a minute, do you have any? We've been talking about this supplemental that you're coming out, the supplement to A Conversation About Race, and I know a lot of people are going to want to know when perhaps they might be able to get a copy or when it'll be ready.
Well, the target date on that is for the 18th of February.
Okay.
So we're coming right up, knock on wood. We'll hopefully have it ready and on the website by the 21st.
Excellent. Well, and of course, I'll be going there for my copy of it. Any idea on the price?
I hope to charge $15.
Well worth it, I'm sure. Well worth it.
$20 for A Conversation About Race. I think they're $25 on Amazon.com. So this one's only going to be a little longer than a half an hour, so we'll try to make it a little cheaper.
Is there perhaps a combo rate there, or is it you're strictly marketing them right now as separate entities? Or I'm not trying to be a marketing expert here, but you know, is there a, for instance, if you buy both, do you get, or is it $40 both, you can take them home and enjoy?
Well, maybe you are a marketing expert, Bill. I think that's a good idea. There should be a combo offer.
But that will appear on the website if we decide to go there. I'm not going to suggest any prices because that's not my field. I know, an expensive paint box, as Orson Welles said, and I'm not going to try to suggest that any prices on anything. But I'll tell you this much. A conversation about race at $20 is a bargain because there's nothing else out there like it, and it is absolutely an eye-opener.
Well, thank you.
I think we mentioned that you mentioned earlier in the show that you, in fact, are going to be speaking at the AMRIN conference hosted by my next guest in the next hour, Jared Taylor.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I'm really looking forward to that. I want to thank Mr. Taylor for the kind invitation that he made to me. I've gotten a lot of flack for accepting this and going to this this conference. I heard that there was some protesters and they tried to get it moved, and I heard some things about whether or not it's moved from one hotel to another. But I just think, as I mentioned to you earlier, my background is as this Republican, or this kind of what we call today kind of a neocon position. I think that the time has come that if we believe this stuff, we better stand up and say it. And so people want to call me what they want for going to this conference. Anyone who knows anything personal about me knows I'm not a white supremacist, and most people know I'm not even a white nationalist. But I think that what I do have to say about just whites being kind of the butt of the jokes and of the problems of our culture, it's been taken far enough. And so people like me, the Republican Party is not interested in guys like me right now, and I hope they come around. I hope they come back to guys like me. But right now, I find people like American Renaissance more representative of my feelings than Michael Steele.
Well, I think that makes sense because, you know, it wasn't the Michael Steeles of the world who have elected Republicans into office. Quite frankly, the constituency has been mostly men like you and me and people, people of our background. And it seems to me they're abandoning their base. And, you know, I want to make the point, and I think it's an important point here, that 97% of the blacks in this country, by most estimates, voted for Obama. And I don't believe they voted for him because of his experience in the Illinois Senate. It's pretty clear to me that they voted for him because he was black, that this was a crossing a threshold, that they were not going to consider any politics. It was strictly tribal, and it was strictly about putting a black man in office. And yet, once again, you know, if we say, well, we're voting our best interest because we're white and we want some of our standard of living to be protected by who we elect, you know, again, this just comes down to being called the big R word, even though it's perfectly reasonable to look after your own best interest.
Well, you're right, and that's why I'm really looking forward at the conference to meeting MP Nick Griffin, because I think he's gotten a lot of heat, too, for just standing up for white people. He's not saying anything bad about anyone else. He's just standing up for whites. And I'll make another point, too. I watched part of the State of the Union the other night, and then I watched the Republican response to the State of the Union. And Republicans are dropping the ball, Bill. If they can't figure this stuff out, when I saw the image, the visual image of the Republican response, did you watch it?
No, I didn't.
A white guy who looks a good-looking, well-spoken white guy, Governor of Virginia. It looks like Thomas Jefferson, but behind him in your image, you've got the mandatory Asian guy, you've got the black woman, you've got the woman down here, whatever. You know, we've got this. People say they're overcome race, or they've overcome race. No, they haven't. Race is so important. When you show a visual image on TV, you've got to have the people behind the president of this race over here, that race, and it's so stupid. We've got to overcome this simplistic mentality that says, oh, look, there's three white people on the image. That's bad. No, it's not. You know, so what? There's three white people on the TV image. It's not the end of the world. In fact, I think whites are the majority in this country.
So far, but again, there's this this mentality that's wrong. That, you know, even Bill Clinton rather wistfully stated when he was in office that we're going to be a minority one day, very soon, as if this is a positive outcome. And
yeah,
yet we know,
like, we've got to overcome this silliness. I've got nothing bad to say about Michael Steele, but we know why Michael Steele was elected to run the Republican Party, to head the Republican Party. And we've got to get off this silliness about race. Even if it turns out that the Republican Party ended up really being a white party, it's about the ideals. It's not about the race. And it's silly to think anything else. I mean, the fact is that you mentioned 97% of blacks voted for Obama. But yet, in Iowa, 34% of whites voted for Obama, too. I mean, who's got the problem with race?
Well, there may be a change in the weather here, because 56% of the people have voted for a Republican in Massachusetts for senator. And this has been clearly a headshot to the liberal Democrats.
Yeah, isn't that
because
something?
That was
Kennedy's chair.
That was his throne, not just chair, it was Kennedy's throne. And this is like overthrowing a monarchy here. I mean, it's the revolution in Massachusetts. And so I do think that that has the Democrats running scared. And of course, the key to their success will be playing the race card and making sure that all of these minorities are behind them, because I think they see a white surge coming and they're really afraid of it.
Oh,
and they're
going
to do everything they can to derail that.
Well, I'm going to do everything I can to help with the white surge.
Me too. I'm doing everything I can, but you know, it's a difficult hill to climb, because the fear out there of receiving the notorious label is so great that, you know, it seems like there's an automatic cave-in to, you know, any suggestion that an elected official might be actually representing his majority constituency. And of course, we don't ever see that among black politicians. They quite clearly know who they represent, and make no mistakes about it, they're going to pursue the best interest of their constituency in Congress, in the Senate, and elsewhere. So, you know, we just, the key, I think, is to elect people who are going to stand up and say, I represent my constituency, and this constituency is 96% white. And they're going to be the people who either keep me in office or throw me out of office.
I think it's coming. I think you're right. And we're going to have to reach that level of maturity where we can say, if this is a room full of white people, there's nothing wrong with it.
Well, no, of course. What would be wrong with it? I mean, where does this intrusion into our lives begin and end? Does it end, in fact, with whites being forced to accept non-whites into their family? And I think that there is a Hollywood tendency going that way with these movies like The Blind Side, which actually it takes place right here in my hometown here in Memphis, Tennessee. This is actually a Memphis phenomenon, the Blind Side.
Oh.
And I can tell you that it's total fiction. The real reasons behind what happened had nothing to do with feeling sorry for a 350-pound black teenager. It had more to do with football and creating a football legacy. It had nothing so much to do with the big, hard white Southerner, rich white Southerners.
Craig, are you suggesting that Hollywood was less than accurate in their portrayal?
Oh, I can't believe it myself, but apparently so. But let me say this. I'm going to mention your website one more time. We're getting ready to go into the next hour, and I want to thank you, Craig, for coming on with me. As always, a joy. Visit Craig Boddicker's website, aconversationaboutrace.com. Buy the video. Look for the supplement. Craig, thanks so much for being on the Political Cesspool.
Believe it or not, there's a third hour of tonight's installment of the Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages.
They call the rise.